train they call the city of New Orleans. I'll be gone 500 miles when the day is done. Dealing card games with the old man in the club car. Penny a point ain't no sons of Pullman porters and the sons of engineers ride their father's magic carpets made of steel. Mothers with their babes asleep rocking to the gentle beat, and the rhythm of the rails is all they feel. Good morning, America, how are you? Said, don't you know me? I'm your native son. I'm the train they call the city of New Orleans. I'll be gone 500 miles when the day is done.
Nighttime on the city of New Orleans. Changing cars in Memphis, Tennessee. Halfway home, and we'll be there by morning.
30 seconds, actually.
Through the Mississippi darkness, rolling down to the sea.
Whatever you want.
But all the towns and people seem to fade into a bad dream, and the steel rail still ain't heard the news. The conductor sings his songs again. Passengers will please refrain. This train got to disappear in railroad blues. Good night, America, how are you? Say, don't you know me? I'm your native son. I'm the train they call the city of New Orleans. I'll be gone.
Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Initech.
No, you're working at Initech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world, and I am a material girl or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Oh, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke. Don't do
if I had $1 million, if I had $1 million, well, I'd buy you a house, I would buy you a house. And if I had $1 million, if I had $1 million.
Stocks, jocks,
Carson Jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now.
Go. Low and Wolfpack Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Allen. Jim Waller on the board. S&P Futures are down $4. NASDAQ futures down 18 as we had a bounce back rally yesterday. But everybody should feel very happy that Walmart is hiking their full year outlook, and they're saying they had the huge tariff refund that they got they're going to use to lower prices for you going forward.
Worship!
Oh, excuse me, what was that?
Worship!
Just saying. We have Professor Lou.
Let me thank you for putting on City of New Orleans, which is one of my all-time favorite songs. And I don't like a lot of stuff by Arlo Guthrie, but that I think probably tops the list even more than Alice's Restaurant.
Probably the reason for that is it's not Arlo Guthrie's song.
Right. Yeah, no, he covered it. Who wrote it originally?
It was written by Steve Goodman.
Oh, that is a Steve Goodman song?
Yep.
Holy cow.
And there was a place that we used to go when I was very young. They had spectacular music, a place called The Quiet Night. It was at Belmont and Sheffield. Belmont and Sheffield, on the second floor of this building. It was kind of one of those, bunch of little stores downstairs. And then there was a big upper floor that went over all the small floors. It's now it's like Tattoo Powers and other crap. But the guy ran that place. He had all these people, really good bands that went in there. Siegel Schwal Blues Band played there every Monday night. I was in there one night, and I go to the waitress. I go, "Hey, these guys are pretty damn good. Who are they?" She goes, "You'll know all about them tomorrow." And I go, "Really?" She goes, "Yeah, they're putting their album out tomorrow with Seals and Croft." And so evidently, Steve Goodman used to, you know, he was big friends with the guy who owned the place, and he used to hang around there all the time and sang there. And he had this song, The City of New Orleans. And the owner read it, and he goes, "That song is unbelievable." He goes, "Well, if you want it to be a hit, it's not going to be you." Because Steve Goodman didn't have that great of a voice. Just so happened, Arlo Guthrie was playing there. He said, "If you want it to be a hit, you got to give it to this guy." So he gave it to Arlo Guthrie, and I think he first sang it there. And Arlo Guthrie made it a hit. But I will say one thing. I mean, if you want to try the rails and do Amtrak, I mean, our buddy John Lee's done the California Zephyr through California in those areas, and he said it was absolutely spectacular. And a lot of people like doing the Empire Builder, which goes through North Dakota and that whole area. But if you want to see the soul of this country, warts and all, take the City of New Orleans down to New Orleans.
Yeah.
It goes right through the downtowns of every small town, every old washing machine on the back porch you're seeing. You go right through the swamp. It is really special. And when you come out of there, I don't know what you'll be thinking, but you'll be thinking. It's really a Larry and I took that to New Orleans. Oh, I took it, you know, a long time ago for the Sugar Bowl game in 1973. But Larry and I took it down to met the girls. His wife and my girlfriend, when we had long story, we stayed in New Orleans for a few days with these huge dogs, and we flew back. But it is, first of all, if you get on the train, if you get the first class sleeper, which we did, you get a porter just like Pullman, and all the meals are included, but you have to sit with other people. And it was so interesting, the people we sat with. First night we sat with a couple of black ladies. One, you know, had a bunch of dough, and one was the cousin she brought with, right? But they were in Chicago. They were doing some shopping. They went to some funeral for some preacher or something. They were spectacular. This one lady, I don't know what she was. I think she was an attorney, Lou. They were absolutely spectacular to talk to. And they took the train to Memphis. And you pull into Memphis at 6 a.m., so they basically got done shopping at Michigan Avenue. Hightailed it over to the Union Station, hopped on, had a nice dinner, slept, got up, and her husband picked them up at the train. It was like they didn't want to take the plane. They'd rather do that. And so you think everybody goes from Chicago to New Orleans. It's actually almost like a local train.
Yeah,
in the meantime,
it makes multiple stops through the South.
I mean, it is the way to get from Jackson, Mississippi to New Orleans. If you don't want to drive, you're not going to hop on a plane to do that. You know,
it's been a long time since I've ridden a train in the U.S. I mean, I was in the Acela corridor when I was working in Washington, and I rode those trains between D.C. and New York or Philadelphia or Baltimore, Philly, Providence, and New York. So, those are commuter rails. Those are almost like riding the Metra in Chicago. It's been a long time since I've taken anything involving a sleeper or extended passenger service. I will say, to your point about sitting with different people at meals, The river cruises that I've taken in Europe involve that, because the tables are all at least four seats and usually 8 or 10, and so you eat with different people. I mean, you on a 2 week trip, you'll settle in with people that you know or you know enjoy talking to, but you do tend to sit with different people at every meal. And that in and of itself is, from my mind, a big selling part of the trip, because you do meet really interesting, different folks with, you know, from different parts of the country, different parts of the world in some cases, and that is a fantastic way to travel. You know, that's one of the reasons you like to travel, is because you get to see different things and meet different people, and that is a great way to do it. The river cruise line that we typically frequent, you know, has English speaking trips, and so you end up with people from Canada, Australia, Great Britain.
Which cruise line do you use? You're not the one that they advertise all the time. You use another one?
Oh, we're usually on Viking.
Okay, guys. All right.
I've been on using them since 2012, and they're a little more expensive than some of the other ones, but it's one of these situations where because my schedule and calendar is so crazy, to sit down and do the planning that it would take for a multi-city stop kind of tour through Europe. Is taken care of by them. You basically just throw money at them and show up at the airport.
One of the guys who owned a couple seats at the SIBO, who's kind of an odd duck. Matter of fact, his kid owns Jimmy John's.
Oh,
this is the guy's name. What the hell's the guy's name? He was a helicopter pilot, Lou, and he owned I don't know how many SIBO seats, like 25. I'll think of the guy's name. He was a character. Plus, he was one of these guys that was very dark skinned, but he was white. And yet he got every minority deal going because he was dark skinned. I'm like, okay, then I'll think of the guy's name. But even when he was in his 50s, he was a stunt pilot, helicopter stunt pilot for movies.
Wow.
And he lived in the top floor of the Jimmy. What's the place on Michigan Avenue? Where the fancy hotel is up a little bit on Michigan Avenue. He lived on the top floor of the place.
You mean 900?
The what? No, it's a name of a regular hotel chain name. Is it the Marriott maybe, or one of those places?
Anyway, was this guy a river?
But he went on one where everybody got a bike, and whenever they stopped every morning, and everybody could take the bike out into the city, and whether if you wanted to or didn't want to, and it was like a bike tour.
Yeah, there's a line called, I think it's AMA, that does a lot of bike tours. The knock on Viking and probably some of these other tours is that
guy's name was Jim Lee.
The average age on the boat is about 75 or 78. So there are a lot of older people on these things, and they're not quite as physically active as you might like.
Well,
I mean, I've done bike tours off of the boat where I, you know, you step off the boat, the bikes are right there, and you get on them and pedal. We did a bike tour down the Danube from Vienna. That was fantastic. You know, riding along the river and the guide was explaining all this local stuff to us, and you know, you ride through these little villages and you know, stop and have a cup of coffee or a glass of wine or whatever, and I mean it was terrific, but Viking tends to segregate their stuff more on the end of kind of easy walks, you know, bus tours, that kind of thing. Having said that, I did what I can only refer to as about a 6 mile forced march through Prague.
Is that where you went and saw all the cathedrals and stuff?
Yes,
it was in Prague. Yeah. What were you telling us about that?
I mean, the walk through Prague was terrific. The we got off the boat and got on a bus that took us to the main castle, and he wandered through there, and then we walked from this castle up on a hill down into the downtown, into the old town of Prague, and then all through that area. And it was great. It was fascinating, and it was at a nice pace. But at the end of the thing, you look at your phone and say, "My God, we just covered 6.2 miles." I think they figured it's a 10-kilometer walk. Wow. And
You did a 10K. You walked.
That's right. So anyway, the advantage of being on a boat like that and sitting down and talking to people is, and the coincidences, you know, the overlaps that happen. I mean, we were at a table with a gentleman who, as it turns out, was like my wife had been in the Navy, and then had attended the same school, Eastern Connecticut University,
wow,
that she had. Back, but they actually had. I think we figured they'd overlapped a year.
And I mean,
the odds of that are pretty small.
Well, Lou, you read some interesting. We had breakfast. You know, we go to breakfast. Well, if we'd had four people, then you get a table. But if you have two, then they're going to put one or two with you. You know? So we get breakfast, and they put this guy across from us, and nice dude. And he was multi. I don't know if he was half white, half black, if he was whatever, you know, he was a multiracial guy. And you look at him, and he's got this weird feeling, very quiet, very nice. He was from Jackson. He goes, "Yeah, whenever I go to New Orleans, I get on there for this and that." And finally, it turns out, I'm kind of looking at him, and you get this weird feeling when you look at somebody, you go, "This guy's a little bit different." And you wouldn't want to be sure you'd mess with him. His arms were, like, chiseled. Finally, he goes, "Yeah, you know, I'm a programmer." And he goes, "But I usually take 2 months off in the summer." And I go, "What are you doing in the summer?" "Well, I take a bunch of kids over to Europe, and we go country to country for judo and taekwondo tournaments."
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And I go, "Is that what you do?" He goes, "Yeah, I'm a..." What do you say? He was a black belt in six different disciplines or something. I'm going, Jesus. You look at this guy, talk about a one-man gang. I mean, you know, he was maybe 5'10 or so, 5'11. Wasn't all that huge or anything like that, but... You just talk about a quiet dude. He goes, "Yeah, I'm like, yeah, whatever. I'm black belt in like five or six disciplines. I lost count." And I'm going, "Oh, really?"
So this is a nice little segue into one of the stories I wanted to talk about. I get these feeds on airline horror stories, and here's the latest. So this guy and his wife get on an airplane, and she gets upgraded to a business class. It's like a 4 or 5 hour flight. She gets upgraded to business class. So he's sitting in economy, she's in business, and she texts him. And this is part of the problem, is that you can now communicate with your significant other during a flight. She texts him during the flight and says, "Hey, they just, you know, they served the meal up here in business class. It's a great meal, but I can't eat. I'm allergic to the roll and the cake dessert. Rather than throw them away, do you want them?" And he goes, "Oh, I'd love them." So he crosses into the business class area just to go up and you know, chats with her for like 2 seconds. She hands him the roll and the cake. He walks back in, sits back down. A flight attendant then sees him and comes up. And guess what happens? She grabs the roll.
And she confiscates the cake. Yeah.
She confiscates both of them, grabs them, marches back into the business class area, and he tells her, "Listen, hey, sorry, I didn't just steal this off somebody's tray. My wife is allergic to it, and we just didn't want to throw the food away." And she says, "You're not allowed to have any food from business class. It's not allowed to cross, you know,
the barrier.
Cross the barrier into, you know, business class. Is nothing for business class is allowed to cross the barrier into peasant class or whatever.
The schlump class."
So, and so she throws it away. And he writes this story up just saying this is kind of stupid. And it caused me to think back when my sister was a flight attendant for Northwest when it still existed. And she would tell stories about the incredibly strict rules. I mean, if, for example, if a flight attendant took a packet of peanuts or stuck one of those Biscoff, you know, packages of cookies in her uniform to nibble on later, and walked off the airplane with it, you got fired.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a no questions asked situation. They didn't care. I forgot about it. I whatever. You were fired. And I just was just looking at this thing. I guess the rule is designed to prevent people from wandering up into business class and taking food, or from having people swap seats. But isn't that pretty easily controlled?
Well, you would think. By the way, you mentioned a couple of weeks ago, and it's caused a little pushback from a lot of our guests when you were explained how you think the airlines are competing. Well, our laissez-faire Austrian economist Hal's like, gee, tell Luna, they're competing within a little bit of a structure that they've created themselves with the government. It's not full competition by any stretch.
Oh, I freely know that. I freely admit that. And, I mean, what I'm talking about in terms of competition is the pricing. You know, you can fly, you can still fly a lot more cheaply than you could before deregulation.
Right.
And I realize deregulation, you know, now sounds or sounds silly, but it was a huge step.
Well, you still have it.
For the better.
You still have it. It's just in different ways. The landing slots, the gates.
Yes. But pricing, it's possible. And I consider this to be a mark of a competitive industry. But I know that the airlines have engaged in what is referred to as regulatory capture of the FAA. I know that. But at the same time, it is still possible to fly so much more cheaply than it was in the early 1970s.
I'm not so sure that if you just called up and went like a business person, it's that much cheaper. I mean, if you avail yourself of 3 weeks out, 2 weeks out, and look for those kinds of things, you can do it. I mean, it's been so long since for the CBOE or anybody, where I had to go tomorrow. I don't know what those prices are like. Do you?
I've short-term booked flights, and you know, if you're within, I think if you're within a week, it's expensive because they're filling again, because you're going in, and if you want a cheap seat, let me back up. If you want, you know, your choice of seating and everything else, it can get expensive.
Well, Monty, we just want to have one.
But if you're just willing to fly, then no. I mean,
well, you can, I mean, when you say like willing to fly, I mean, I can't. I could. I with the seats the way they are now, there's no way that I can. Well, I guess there is. I could squeeze my. It's not squeezing my ass in. What am I doing with my legs? I mean, my Monty went on. He went to Florida for something. This friend of ours, and Audrey was going to do the same thing. He went on. He might have gone. Was on Spirit or one of those things. And he.
Oh God.
Well, I mean, but the same thing was Southwest. Audrey ran into the same problem with Southwest. You get a seat, and then okay, well, if you want a little extra leg room, because Audrey's 5'9", 5'10", that's more. And if you want an exit row, the up, and if you have a bag, by the time you're done, the little extra room in the seat, not in the seat, and the legs and the baggage, that was more than the ticket. So it's a total, but I saw something. I was going to send it to you a little bit, Robert. I saw something yesterday on YouTube regarding stewardesses in the '60s.
Stewardesses
and how airlines competed in those days, and they competed by having smoking hot stewardesses, basically.
That was one attraction, yeah.
Well, okay, but they went through the whole routine of applying to be a stew. In 1965 or 68, and how you had to be between 21 and 27.
They weighed you.
No husband, no kids. And out of 30 applicants at United, they would take one. And you had to look absolutely the part. You had the lipstick, You had to have the hat. Your hair had to be to a thing because you always wore the hat, absolutely perfect. In the outfit, they got this picture of this, you know, the head stool lady going around and yanking people's skirts up, checking to see if they had the right girdle on. I'm going, whoa. they all had hose. They all had the shoes were absolutely polished. Said it would take somebody like an hour and a half or two to get ready to show up for the plane. And that was how they competed. It was, and they competed with the food. They competed with everything else because that was so. Yeah, they competed out the ass.
Well, they're not competing on the attractiveness of their flight attendants now. That's for
no.
Sure.
I mean, well, now it's that. Well, and I think what happened to airline thing, and you know, people service is weird. But I was right when I was at Pullman and really at Allied Balance. When I first came out of college. It was right when this change was happening, to where the business guy. Absolutely, would get stoned on his seat. But the guy next to him, if you wanted to see a flight that made money, I flew to Cleveland two or three times for Allied Van Lines. Chicago to Cleveland, every seat was taken, and it was like a lot of dough. It was $200-$300 in those days, and we're talking about a plane that was stuffed, and all you got was like coffee. And boy, those girls had to hustle because you're only in the air an hour, and if somebody didn't get a cup of coffee and a roll, they were bitching a blue streak because, you know, they paid through the nose. Well, then, all of a sudden, you got to the point where some poor business guy like you is paying $600 sitting next to some schlump. I mean, you still dressed up more in those days, but still sitting some guys who paid $99, and all of a sudden, the stewardess has treated everybody like they were $99 people. And there is the one business guy sitting there going, hey, I just paid a lot of money for this. I can't even get a cup of coffee. What the hell's going on? There was a huge turnover. Now, I would guess, I haven't flown in a while, that if you're in steerage, you're getting treated like, you know, you're a schlump, I'm my guess.
It's not necessarily that. But again, my point is, you have a lot in terms of choices, and you pay for them. You have a lot more choices. And what has happened is airfares have been creeping up because the cost of operation is creeping up, and the airlines are desperately trying to maintain what I call the sort of bus stop or bus station ethic that, you know, started in the 1970s. My sister said that she thought deregulation was a disaster because the class of people that she was dealing with that now could fly rather than taking a train or a bus was completely different. And she said, we're dealing with a whole different group of folks who really don't know how to act on, you know,
well, that
in public or
that
or
wasn't, that wasn't the
80s
or 90s. That's now. I mean, you know, people don't know.
Oh no, it was in the 80s. It was in the late 70s when deregulation. She stopped being a flight attendant, I think, in the early 90s, and she said the changeover was dramatic. And when I talked to her, and I said, well, what's it like now? And she said, my friends who are flight attendants now say that it's horrific.
Well, it's disgusting. People are wearing muscle shirts and shorts, and I mean,
dress code. I mean. In any event, I don't want to complain about air travel. I just want to say that the changeover in terms of services and whatever, you have a very, very wide selection in terms of how you want to fly. If all you want is an airplane ride, then you can get a very inexpensive seat. If you're flying, for example, like on a day trip, which I used to do regularly, where I would literally get on an airplane with a briefcase and travel to wherever I was going and, you know, come back the same day. I wasn't overnighting. If you want to do that, you can fly very inexpensively. If you're flying, you know, an extended trip, you know, multiple hours. I mean, I was on an airplane for 14 hours, you know, earlier this year. You can generally get yourself a seat with extra leg room and whatever. You pay for it, but you can structure it. You know, I want an extra leg room aisle. Extra
right, but it,
leg
but it
room,
ends up
whatever.
Being not the same. It's like here, a car is $30,000. Well, you want a steering wheel? Well, that's another two.
they commoditize all kinds of stuff. I think, and I don't know if this trend has continued, but you know, we talked about this whenever it first rolled out, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, where BMW, if you bought a BMW, you bought a subscription so that you could turn on your seat heaters, or you bought a subscription so that you could, you bought a subscription so that you could turn on the certain aspects of the navigation system. The seat heater thing was the thing that just broke me. I thought you've got to be kidding.
And it's,
I'm buying a $65,000-$70,000 car. This was.
But when you, beautiful. I mean, we're going with this. When you talk about competition, I mean, you could probably get some. I won't say imbecile, but somebody who's unclear on the concept from Commonwealth Edison saying that they're competitive because every once in a while they get something in the mail that says you can buy your power from Indiana or some crap. That doesn't make it competitive. I'm sorry.
I see the airlines basically, and I realize that your vision of competition and mine are different because you're an economist and I'm a lawyer.
Well, if you open up the gates and you open up the landing slots and those kinds of things, then I'd say go for it, but they don't.
So, part of the reason they don't do that, I think, is the kind of chaos that would introduce. Until it shook out, the kind of chaos that would introduce into the air traffic control system and into our flight operations, and that is a dead set loser in terms of politics.
Well, if you decide you want to Lou and Chief Airline, we're gonna grab two older 757s and we're gonna fly back and forth to Vegas, and we're gonna have a price where.
And we'll fly out of that Hooters Airline airport in northern Indiana. Well, where is that? Gary? Is that the Gary Airport?
Yeah, but it was Hooters Air.
I call it the Hooters Airport because Hooters was flying out of it, but in Gary.
But what you're gonna end up doing is having United and American and Southwest all of a sudden totally discount flights to Vegas to screw with the new airline.
Possibly true.
Which, you know, is called predatory pricing. By the way, it's against the Clayton Act, but nobody cares about the Clayton Act anymore.
It might be against the Clayton Act. I mean, I'm actually in the middle of an antitrust case right now.
Really?
And yes. And I will. I mean, I'm not personally a monopolist.
Are you defending, or are you?
I'm defending.
Okay.
So the claim, you know, it's a claim involving supposedly coordinated pricing, which is what a lot of these cases are, coordinated pricing. But, you know, I know that you like to read, I think I've mentioned this before, you read the statute. It's very straightforward. It's very simple language. It is layered with exceptions and interpretations that have developed.
Well, the Sherman Act isn't. The Sherman Act stayed simple. The Clayton Act and the Robinson-Patman Act, those got pretty complicated.
Those get a little more complicated, but still, they're layered with exceptions and interpretations that have been put in place by the courts, because the courts understand that that simply applying the language in this straightforward way captures all kinds of conduct that isn't anti-competitive.
In somebody's mind, but it's sort of like.
Well, okay. But so I mean, for example,
but you talk a lot about legislative or. Judicial legislation, okay.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you'll talk about. I mean, we could. I'll just a couple of.
And by the way, I think it's stupid that's how we've let the law develop rather than having Congress do it.
Well, and I'll give you two total huge examples, and I'm going to get everybody texting in that I'm wrong on this, but I'm not. You look at insider trading. And this crap would again yesterday. I have to watch this crap would. All of a sudden, the market rallies up huge, and the gold runs up $150 or something because the Secretary of the Treasury decides he's going to start buying long-term bonds, and the bonds shoot up. Okay, well, somebody front ran that. Now, and you can go. There's somebody will say, and regulatory people, if it was on here, they'd tell me I'm a blithering idiot. What do you mean? There's all kinds of rules regarding insider trading. Bullshit. There's all kinds of stuff from the SEC and FINRA and those kinds of people in the NASD where there's been cases, and they've sort of defined in their mind what insider trading is, which kind of protects the biggest people because they never go after them. It goes after the little guy. But I challenge you to find one law from Congress that said, here's a law against insider trading and here's what insider trading is. There isn't one. And yet there's this massive bureaucratic, whatever you want to call it, definition of all over the place without one that you can say. Matter of fact, the definition on the CBOE floor for a long time, you know, I've been there for 20-some years, but if somebody came, you're in my definition, and Mr. Lawler's probably would be something like, hey, if somebody got some news that they shouldn't have and traded ahead of me, that's wrong. Okay, well, that's pretty simple. Well, their definition was, because you see firms down here all the time would come down and buy these calls, and you'd say, okay, why are they buying these calls? And sure enough, the stock would print up like a minute and a half later. Well, obviously they had the stock order in their hand and they ran into the options before they placed the stock order. I mean, duh. And I'm not that dumb to know what's going on. And so their definition was, even if they knew about it, if they didn't participate on the sell side of the stock trade, it was okay. And I'm going, what bureaucratic moron came up with that? So in other words, if they didn't actually buy the option from you at this price, when they already had the sale of the stock at the price that was going up 2 seconds later, that they were not guilty. And I'm going, what difference does that make? they still picked you off. I mean, but and when, you know, what's the I mean, how many of these are there? These little pitfalls. Everybody gets to define this all the way on their own.
And yet, well, the pitfalls. I mean, with regard to antitrust stuff. The pitfalls are all, as I said, done by courts where and literally this is a court stepping into an area where Congress just
Well, this isn't even a court. This is an administrative group of government.
Well, the administrative stuff is even worse.
Yeah.
So because there's like zero accountability within that. In any event, my point is that the regulatory issues that sit out here with respect to, you know, what constitutes competition are incredibly complicated and multiple tests, none of which you will find in the statute, and I'm not thrilled about that. I think that's a mistake. But the point I was leading to, so the kind of chaotic market driven solution that you talk about with the airlines, and I noted that would be, you'd have chaos until things shook out, and that could take years. This is what's happening right now in college sports, and I don't know if you saw this, but there are something like 30 guys who have been drafted or signed by NFL teams that are now eligible to go back to college if they get cut.
Why not?
By the NFL teams.
Why not?
Oh, I don't like the idea that you can leave your college program, go get employed by somebody else, get employed by a professional sports team, and then suddenly come back to college.
What's your argument? That one is pro and one isn't? They're both pro.
Yeah, there's a firewall there.
Where? And, not anymore.
And well, that's my point. So
you're gonna tell the guy making Shanny was, I saw him last week, and there's a basketball player evidently at Vanderbilt making $45,000 a month. I'm sure other people are making more. So the dude
in NIL, right?
Yeah. So the dude goes gets drafted by the NBA, and he's got a year of eligibility left or two. Doesn't make the team. Decides he's going back to college. What are you gonna accuse him of? He was a pro for 2 weeks. He's been a pro the whole time.
Well, my and again, from a philosophical perspective, I agree with you. But if I'm the NCAA, I'm sitting there going, I do not want that firewall broken. And if I'm the NFL, I don't want guys going back, launching back and forth between these programs. For one thing, it plays havoc with the CBA in terms of the collective bargaining agreement, in terms of accrued seasons.
Well, maybe that's going to shake up too.
Well, I'm just saying this is the kind of chaos, and my personal opinion is that they've tried to keep that. They've tried to keep that separate for a long time because of the dangers of this kind of crossover. But we've talked about this, that eventually we're going to end up with a more formal feeder semi-pro system that's going to feed to the NFL.
My Notre Dame legacy, you know, I could have gone to school anywhere, but I have 10, well, 9 now, because since Bob died, but 10 of the best friends you ever could make. And these dudes are way more in love with the school than I ever was since we left. I mean, I was liked it when I was there because I had great people around me, but they are locked in to a certain extent. Not everybody, surely not Kevin, because Kevin's on top of everything, but they're pretty much locked into somehow or another we can be half a gangster. As long as we've got Friedman as our coach and he still wants people going to class, we can somehow be part of the old way. And I don't, to me, this is maybe because I read Rick Tellender's book 30 years ago. You're going to have, and are having, these are professional teams. And you're looking at this as an attorney, and you've done all these contracts and these stuff. Lou, these people are now a competitor to the NFL. They're no longer the feed to the NFL. They're going to start playing on Sunday. They're a full-born, full-ass competitor in 5 years. And whether you get drafted and you come back, what difference does it make? The kid's making more in college than he signed for the pros, and he goes, "I don't like this. I'm going back to school." How do you stop that once the waterfall is over the edge?
Well, I agree. My point was, you know, this is chaotic. It's unregulated. This is a court decision, by the way, that granted an injunction that these players had wanted. But if you're, I agree with you. I mean, we now, our football system now starts to look more like FIFA with regulated layers of professionalism and competence. And so we have guys flowing from, you know, the collegiate game. And I agree with you. I think college football is going to compete with the NFL. And I think the NFL is going to, and now, this will get interesting. Because of the elevated status of collective bargaining agreements, the NFL could, I think, shut down this whole pipeline by collectively bargaining an agreement that it restricts the movement of these players. And I'm wondering.
I don't think you can. Well, you're more in tune about that, but. Just as a,
oh,
as
no,
an absolute,
I mean, I mean, I think, I,
I'm,
I
may.
It's an interesting question, but I think they could do it. And so the question now is, if you're the union, if you're the players' union, what are you interested in doing? Are you interested?
But you don't
in
cover the college kids.
Pardon me.
You don't cover the college kids.
Well, but they don't want a situation, I don't think, where the market for competition with the union members suddenly explodes because people can move easily back and forth between the two classes of football.
Well, I'm curious as to what manner of judge, or anybody, assuming they're not all crooked, what manner of judge, if some kid gets drafted as a junior to play tackle for the Bears, gets his head beat in for 6 weeks in training camp and gets cut. You're going to tell me the kid can't go back to school and not play?
Oh, he can go back to school.
Why not? Why not?
Well, because...
Bears don't want him.
Well, but the depending on the arrangement, a CBA could say, if you come from college and you enter in, you are going to play for us, you can't... If you leave to go play back at school again or back at college again, you're ineligible to come back into the NFL. That's one way. I don't see why the NC2A couldn't restrict it.
Well, I mean, if it's one thing if you're in basketball and you grab somebody and you sign them to a 5-year deal or something, if you cut them, you still got to pay them. But in football, the guy tries out for the Bears. He didn't make it. I mean, you know. Philosophically,
I tend to agree with you. From a legal, a labor law perspective, I could see the NFL or the Players Association saying we want to discourage guys bumping back and forth between college and the pros because it damages or it's bad for our union members.
I'm sure it is. But Lou, we start the world by, in my opinion, and the thing I'm always fighting against, what if PTI had an attractive lady here that worked for us, and she goes, "Hey, I need 2 weeks off to go, I just got signed by the Dallas Cheerleaders." She goes down there for 2 weeks. They don't like her. They bounce her. She can't come back and work for us. I mean, what are we talking about? I mean, name this. How we're talking about? We are talking about two professional leagues here. If we're not there yet, we're a week away. So one league signs you. They don't want you. They're gonna prevent you to go back from the other league. I mean, come on. It's like
sure
saying.
We could.
I mean,
the CB. If you sign a collective bargaining agreement that alters eligibility for people who are doing this, you could shut that down. And again, it's just a question. I think.
I would want my friend Lou. If somebody made me sign an agreement to go sign up for the Bears, either a seventh round pick or somebody who was undrafted, that if I go there and get my head beat in and get cut after 5 weeks, I couldn't go play anywhere else. I'm going to say my friend Lou is going to make that one look like a monkey agreement in court.
It depends. It depends on what, again, the classic lawyer answer. It depends. It depends on where the restriction is located. If the restriction is located in a personal contract that you're signing, yeah, we could be in court tomorrow and defeat that. If the restriction is contained in a collective bargaining agreement, that's a whole different matter.
But you can't. The NFL people can't just extend their agreement to the college people.
The NFL union could set language into the collective bargaining agreement that either prohibits guys from bouncing back and forth between college football and
I'm going to agree with you. If the kid goes back to Notre Dame for his fourth year, I suppose they could say you get one shot at the apple in the NFL and that's it.
They could probably do that,
but you can't tell Notre Dame they can't let the kid play football.
Well, it would be some kind of, I'm trying to think of how I would word it if I was writing the CBA, I'd have to think about it, but it would be some kind of restriction that would be done with the NC2A where they would just, you know, this whole fight, for example, is about years of eligibility. This latest ruling doesn't deal with the what I think you and I are discussing, which is the ultimate question. Which is going back and forth between amateur and pro. The ruling right now is the NC2A put an absolute 5-year cap on playing. You get 5 years. End of discussion.
Question for
That's
the Lou.
It.
Ask Lou why moving between the NFL and college would be any different from moving between Canadian football and the NFL.
Agreed. I mean, conceptually, there's not much difference except again the pro amateur barrier.
There's no doubt in my mind, Lou, that the union and the NFL is going to try and exert influence over another league. There's no doubt they're going to try, but I'm just saying
they can make it. So the NC2A has this 5-year rule. The fight that got these guys declared eligible to go back to college was a ruling that they can't, if they've got a year of eligibility left, the NC2A cannot block them from going back right now.
Yeah.
Because they've still got a year of eligibility left. And that's, I think
you're going to end up with, as long as you're in college, you're eligible. But take, for instance, The Natural, Lou. One of my favorite movies. Roy Hobbs shows up. They don't want to play him. If they were to cut him, you're saying he couldn't go back and play for the Hebrew Oilers?
Good question. But if it's a school, as I said, the distinction is the college, the amateur pro distinction. That's the issue, and that's what you and I are. That's where you and I.
Hey, can we? We got a few minutes left. Can we change? You and I have talked for a long time, and I think I was pushing on it, and I don't think you're all that disagreeing that over the last 20 years, 25 years, our armed forces have gotten incredibly sophisticated on these, call it 2 to 3 week, month war stuff where we just totally overwhelm everybody. And I've always been, we had, of course, Afghanistan was forever, but that was kind of different. I was always the thing where when you go down from 16 aircraft carriers to 10 or 8 or whatever the hell we have in, that can move now, that all of a sudden if that doesn't work out, is our supply, is our stuff ready for a 6 month, 8 month war? And it seems like your and my fears are,
oh yeah,
are definitely poking our head out of the ground here.
Which, yeah, with the Lincoln.
Well, evidently, yeah. I was. Of course, you can't believe half the stuff you read, you see on YouTube. They're saying part of the problem with the Lincoln is one of the Iranian attacks. I don't know, drone. I don't know what the hell they're using. Hit one of our supply depots in one of these other countries, and the supply depot was one that was very much involved in supplying these ships at sea. I have no idea if that's true or not. Could it be?
As I understand it, the claim is that when they hit the naval headquarters building in Bahrain, that shut down our ability to use that port or that facility as a staging area for resupply. So now the supplies are coming from much further away, Singapore,
okay,
and some other port in Indonesia, I think, and so it makes it almost impossible to ship fresh fruit, vegetables, that kind of stuff. They have to.
If you had to guess, we had Hal on yesterday, gave an amazing, I think, talk regarding what it's like to be on a ship, especially, well, the Lincoln's not aging, but he was on one that was totally aging. And when he was at sea a long time, wasn't 200 days because they had port calls, but he said when you're on an aging ship, a lot of the maintenance just, you know, goes down the drain because you can't keep up with it. And it gets worse and worse the longer you're out there. If you had to guess on the Lincoln, how much of it is just supply stuff, you know, not enough toothpaste, not enough, you know, or how much of it is after 10,000 ups and downs, his elevator needs to be taken apart and redone, and by the way, we're at 12,000. How much of it, if you had a percentage, which do you think is more the problem? The first or the second?
Probably the second. The first in terms of getting stuff there, that can be fixed with a surge. And in fact, we just activated a personnel deployment vessel backstop. It's called the Air Force, it was called the Ready Reserve. Or a Civil Reserve Air Fleet. The Navy, I think, calls it something else. But we've just activated a couple of ships on the West Coast that are designed and purposed to move people and get people, you know, rotated in and out of areas along with supplies. So you can short-term surge that capability, the supply capability. You can't short-term surge the maintenance issue. I mean, if the boat's got to be taken offline for routine maintenance and repair, then that stuff adds up, and you're not, because they're engaged in a sort of a continuous combat operation, with all the stress on the services and everything else that involves, you can't make those kinds of repairs without shutting the boat down. And so the longer you don't do that, the more stuff breaks, and they're gonna have that problem. We've moved a carrier now to come in and relieve the Lincoln. They'll pull it offline and I hope take the thing apart and fix all the issues. But yeah, I mean, it's a manifestation of something that I saw when I was flying. I mean, an aircraft, it the impact is more dramatic. You know, a ship can function with its toilets, you know, not at full efficiency for weeks.
There is, after all, the side of the boat.
There is the side of the boat, and there are other things you can do that allow you to continue to operate. In an airplane that is being stressed, and I was flying, so the aircraft that I flew on in the 1970s and 80s were old. They were old 135 airframes that had been built in the 1950s. So those airframes were
essentially the early 707s, right?
Yes, 717 I think was the official designation.
Because they're a little narrower.
Yes, but those airframes are still flying, Tom. I mean, they are still flying. Aircraft that were built in the 1950s with thousands and thousands of landings and takeoffs on them and carrying a ton of weight. So I can only imagine what kind of stuff they're doing to it now. But in the 70s and 80s, when I was flying on those older aircraft, we would, you know, stuff broke. And if we got into a quasi combat or to war tempo operation, and we would practice this, you would surge this, you start watching your capability of the systems on the aircraft start to deteriorate. And let me tell you, if you're on a 15 or 16 hour mission, and I had plenty of those, when your in-flight toilet breaks, and there was one for the airplane, when your in-flight toilet breaks, that's a problem, you know, with a crew of 40 guys. When your air conditioning system shuts down and you've got a plane that's basically a flying computer and you can't cool the equipment, that's an issue. When your air refueling receptacle breaks because the you can't get the door open because that has not been checked with the kind of regularity that it needs. So these on an airplane, this stuff happens instantly. And you basically lose the aircraft. You can't fly it, or alternatively, your capability gets degraded such that it's pointless to fly it. With a ship, it takes longer to do that, but the result is the same. So long answer to your question, it's the second. It's not the resupply, it's the maintenance.
I think you're absolutely right. But, you know, the funny part, Hal, you know, sometimes you I love talking to the guy because he says stuff. I don't even think he realizes how profound the stuff he says is. He's talking about how this is the old, there's a new Truxton. His name of his ship was the Truxton. It was a nuclear-powered, either like really small cruiser or big destroyer, whatever you want to call it. And he goes, it was a nuclear-powered thing, right? Because it was getting so old. He goes, they were supposed to be, when he was in the Persian Gulf where he didn't go topside for 30 days. The water was 90 degrees, but when they were supposedly in an aircraft carrier group, right? It was a few times I went topside. I never saw any other ships. I don't know where the hell they were. We were supposedly in this group, but the thing, the ship, I was reading all about it yesterday. It's designed to go 31 knots, and he all goes, we couldn't come close to that. So how the hell do you keep up with an aircraft carrier group? He said when they brought it back, I guess, you know, and it never went out again, they came back from Australia for the Persian Gulf. I think he said Australia to Seattle. He goes, we never made over 10 knots. We were afraid it was going to shake apart. What good is that thing doing out there at 10 knots? It's like a friggin' Liberty ship.
it's a gun. If it's a cruiser, it's a gun platform.
But he said it wasn't really. They had 1 4- or 5-inch gun, a couple of missiles, and a few torpedoes. I was reading a thing up on it. It was like an either really small cruiser or a slightly bigger destroyer. It was kind of a half-assed mid-sized boat that just happened to be nuclear. He goes, but we're cooking along at 9 miles per hour. I mean, what are we doing?
Listen. This is the old line. You go to war with what you got, and the genius of our, in my opinion, our enlisted guys and our engineering people, the genius of those guys in a war zone is that they fabricate, they adjust, they fix, and they invent. I see Andrew and Wayne are in, and I'm cutting into their time. But I would just tell you, go back and look at Gulf War I when we took those Apache helicopters that were designed for operating in basically Northern Europe, and throw them into the desert, and look at the fixes that those enlisted crew chiefs made to get those things running.
Well, you know, they didn't use any of the ones they used on the when they went to get the hostages in Iran.
Well, that's right. Yeah,
what a fiasco those were.
That was a wake up call. All right, you guys have a terrific weekend.
Are you guys going to get any snow this year? Or you can fill up the Lake Mead or what?
They're predicting major snowfalls up here this year.
Well, you need it. You need it. Otherwise, Lake Mead will be dry.
Yeah. Not just Lake Mead.
Yeah.
You guys take care.
Right.
Right.
We got our guys. SP futures down 25. The NASDAQ futures down 141. So we've given away a lot of yesterday, even with the Treasury's move on the long term rates. We've got Andrew and Wayne.
You've got me here.
How are you, bud?
Morning.
We've been going back and forth with stuff, and we've had people doing some talking, and you've been listening in. What comment on what you want, Andrew? Where do you want to start?
Well, I want to start that Lou very nicely said he's cutting into our time. I'm enjoying it, listening. He and Hal earlier in the week really make these kind of news stories come alive with firsthand experience at the, in Lou's case, highest level of air flight. So it's very productive.
Well, he used to fly as close to Russia as they could get in these electronic warfare planes. And they got buzzed a bunch of times. The Russians weren't all that happy about it. I mean, they were as close as they could get, you know, and sometimes maybe a little too close.
They were called ferret missions.
Really? What was the definition of that?
The reason we flew close was to get the Soviets, and probably, I don't know how much of it is going on now, but we'd get the Soviets to fire up their radars and their other systems so we could spot whether their radars were operating on new frequencies or they were fielding a brand new radar system. And then our counter electronics people would get to work on that. There was an entire group at the National Security Agency where I worked for a time that was responsible for that.
Okay. That's I could see where if your air conditioning goes out and all of a sudden all your electronic equipment starts to overheat, what do you do?
The other interesting thing is the closer we move to, say, the Soviet border or the Chinese or North Korean, all the chatter on their communication circuits would start going wild. So we'd be picking that stuff up too to see. Well, let's see who's on these new communication circuits, and we especially loved it when some general, Soviet or Chinese general, would get on there and start, you know, hollering at people.
Well, but the part that he doesn't mention very often is that Lou speaks of fluent Russian. That was one of the reasons why he was on, and it also when his first law firm, why he was over there, and all the Russian deals, they would send him over because he could speak Russian, which is
it's not an easy language to speak. I was in the Soviet Union a year before it collapsed, and then when I got back, a certain three-letter agency asked me for a debrief, which I was surprised. If you guys don't know what's going on over there, what do you think I'm going to tell you, right? I mean, not only the fact they use the Cyrillic script, which looks like it's got a bunch of backward letters, but they also their language, they don't have a lot of what we have in English. They have very few articles that they use. So if you're going to say my brother is a doctor, it would actually, in Russian, it would be moi brat fizik, my brother doctor. That's it.
Okay. There's not enough there's not what you call verbs and stuff.
Yeah, so I don't know why people got so of course, it was translated, but Dostoevsky, War and Peace, too. I mean, it was so big. That book was voluminous, but it didn't have any articles in it. Why was it so voluminous, and even in Russian?
Well, I know you guys aren't you know more than you're out there. Why are this buying of these long-term bonds that came through the other? Of course, to me, it was so front-run and scary. I don't know when these people are all going to go to jail, but maybe, probably never. Nobody goes to jail. But where does the Treasury get the money to do that? It's kind of the they're supposed to sell the bonds with the idea of financing the government. If somebody wants to put money in the system, the Fed turns around and buys the bonds back with essentially made-up money. Okay, if they want to do that, if they want to increase the money supply, increase the money in the pool. Well, it seems a little odd to me that all of a sudden the Treasury is. Now, the Fed also, because they own $6.5, $7 trillion of government, a lot of it's government paper and mortgages, they're actually getting interest on that stuff from both the government and who's ever paying the mortgages and the mortgages they own. So they do get this influx of cash that once or, I don't know how many times a year, I used to know when I hung around with the guys from the Fed, they actually turn in and give that money back to the to Treasury. So they're always really proud of themselves, which how much money they give back to the Treasury, an interest the Treasury has essentially paid them on bonds they bought. So it's kind of a circle jerk to start with. But is that the money you think they, I mean, where exactly would he get a bunch of money, a portion to go buy 30-year bonds, unless it was one of those payments or something else? I mean, I don't really know where he got the money to buy the yen 2 weeks ago. They claim they used euro dollars, but where do you think, when, where does the Treasury get that kind of flexibility? I don't know. Do you?
I have no idea. I hear Andy is printing currency down in his basement.
Well, that could be. I just hope he's not like the Confederacy, where the Confederacy was so bad that people were able to counterfeit it and made it even worse.
Well, I'm about to violate the first law of radio, which is to confess I don't know on your question, but I would expect their credit's reasonably good if they're talking to the right people. And I was just looking this morning at a picture of top regulators at the White House who were all basically cheerleading for what the president does yesterday. So I have a feeling it's a happy family of regulators and doers, and the kind of questions you pose are not at the top of people's concern.
Well, let me ask you this. Is two, certainly in the morning, sober dudes, what is the worst announcement? This morning the headlines is that we blew through $40 trillion, like 2 days ago, in national debt. Okay. Now that's not a good thing. But, you know, that happened, where are we, Thursday? I think that was the announcement. Was it Tuesday night? Or whenever the hell it came out.
Yeah.
You know, we're already $51 billion over that in 2 days. That's a number.
Well, it's announced, and then, you know, it's in the background for some people, but what's not there is a kind of media machine of concern that will almost certainly gear up if any Democrats are elected. Then suddenly, every day, it becomes part of a story that, oh, the Democrats are thinking of spending money. We can't do anything like that. And I'll just say it's a relatively small-time expense, but I'm looking at fencing going up in downtown Washington again for this Grand Prix race, and I see that the National Guard people are now going around in fours. It started with two people, and now it's four. And I've heard that that's going to be extended for years. 5,000 National Guard people coming around. And here we've had UFC fights. We've had festival games. And this weekend we're having a Grand Prix auto race that's basically closing down downtown Washington, and already the fencing makes it very hard to get around. And I'm thinking, who's paying for this? And why is this the top national priority, to be destroying all these buildings down here, putting on these circus-like attractions that not that many people show up to see? But isn't there a time that people are supposed to appropriate money balance the budget?
No, they have no heart. No. By the way, we are. I have my stopwatch out here. Now, you guys will appreciate this. It's actually one of the old red stopwatches. We're not talking about my phone. So, I've got the U.S. debt clock up here. A few years ago, when Greg Pappas was helping out in the show before he got the job we had a trade earlier, he clocked the $1 million at like 40-some seconds. And then like a year or two later, he clocked it at 34. I've got, my fingers is not the best here. I've got us doing $1 million every 20 and a half seconds.
Yeah.
That's a number, you think?
It's like your Senator Everett Dirksen once said, a billion here, a billion there, pretty soon it adds up to real money.
Yeah.
if you also go back in history, you think people like Ulysses Grant, who the general, and I think he's from Illinois, who basically won the Civil War for the Union, he left office with virtually no money. Truman, World War II president, and afterwards, he left office with only his pension from World War I. And now we think, why shouldn't a president be making billions of dollars while president, along with his family? And some people seem to think, how is that part of the American tradition?
Well, there's a lot of schools of thought on that. And my view has been shaped by a Nobel Prize winner, which he wasn't when I had him in class, but I took class from him twice, George Stigler. And to a large extent, you guys, especially you, Andrew, you would have appreciated his classes and his... He was a behavioral economist, where Milton Friedman was more of a monetarist and those kinds of things. But the process, the thought process, and he's written all kinds of pamphlets and books. And I have a bunch of them, and I go through them from time to time. And he does this constant thing about how well does government govern? And one day in class, somebody asked him, he goes, why is Chicago, how can you fix the corruption in Chicago? He goes, I can fix it tomorrow. And the kid says, how the hell are you going to do that? He says, well, you've got a situation where you've got aldermen, you got 50 aldermen, that you pay them nothing because you think they're stealing, right? it's a part-time job, and they get to be lawyers and get to be an Eddie Verdoliak and prosecute cases against the city and whatever. They get to do all that stuff, so you pay them nothing. And then you're pissed off when they steal. He goes, you can't have it both ways. He said the mayor of Chicago at the time, Richard Jay, was mayor, and he goes, I think he was making 40 or 45 grand a year. He said every big business in the city, not to mention Ford and General Motors and stuff, are making, 250, 300. They weren't making millions like they are now. He said they're making 10 times more than the guy. And he goes, and yet he probably has as big a budget and as many people under him as they do. Now, go ahead. He says, but if you wanted to stop the corruption, you would pay the mayor $500,000 a year. But guess what? You give him a check for 100. The other 400 goes into escrow. And every year that he's not convicted of something or being charged with anything, that money starts to accrue to him.
We had a similar situation just the other day here in Florida with the election for the Democratic Senate seat. We had Alexander Vindman, who's a twin brother, is a congressman from Virginia, but they were both in the National Security Council in the first Trump term. And they both were whistleblowers about Trump trying to shake down Zelensky for dirt on the Bidens and return for weapons. Vindman was the choice of the party establishment, ex-military, retired lieutenant colonel. He was running against an insurgent from the, I won't say the Democratic Socialists. She joined them, but she's not been an activist, is this Angie Nixon. She had no money. Vindman, I think, put together a war chest of around $16 million. So he had much more money than she did. But here's the problem with him. He probably anticipating that he's going to be indicted with this politicized Justice Department for what happened back in the first Trump impeachment. He sandbagged his campaign cash. He did very little person to person campaigning. Did put some into TV ads, but Nixon beat him and beat him badly because he was looking, I think, more at getting his own reserves ready for a possible indictment than in winning that election for the Senate. So, I talked to a couple Democrats here, and they said this general election will be the first time they ever voted for Nixon.
I don't know if you guys listened in on Wednesday. We had the return of Eric Mayo. We hadn't been on for a long time, and Eric is one of the most articulate people I've ever come across. By the way, he's a guy kind of like you, Andrew. When he first came out of school, he worked for the Tribune here, and I think he was a beat reporter on the streets for, I think it was the Post, but it might have been the others, for a while in Washington. And he I remember him telling me one day he covered murders, and he was doing like one or two murders a week. And all of a sudden, crystal meth showed up, and it jumped to like 12 and instantly, however many years ago that was. Because it was an amazing difference, and all of a sudden the crystal meth showed up. But anyway, he was there. I was asking him about, you know, some young people that I was talking to last weekend, younger than us, and they're all in on this. They don't know what socialism means, right? But they're absolutely against what we have now, and I don't even know if anybody can put a name on what we have now. It's some sort of a plutocracy / crony capitalism. It's something. And there's competitive parts to it as well, but not that many. I mean, if you think about it, and he was much more articulate than me. He said the younger people, and he still keeps track. He was a teacher at Columbia, taught creative writing. He said the younger people just look at what's happening and they see a certain cadre of people that are in these corporations that seem to get rid of all the corporations around them, have this massive amount of wealth. Now they sort of control the media. And they're all tied into government somehow. He goes, they just look at this and they go, whatever that is, we're against it. And if you lob the term like socialism at them, well, if that's against it, we'll be one of those guys. They're not even really been able to explain to you what a socialist is, because I don't think any of them are close to being socialist, to be honest with you. So where am I missing here? Is he right?
I think so. I mean, they're young people. They don't know the history. They don't know the definition of the terms, but they're operating from what they see around them, and what they see is not really fair, and they're reacting against it. And I don't think they know. As Wayne pointed out, this woman who won in Florida, Angie Nixon, she only became a Democratic Socialist in June or something. It was probably to get advantage of that momentum, but that doesn't mean she's signed on to the intrigues of the National Party, which are pretty bad. It's pretty pro-Putin and so forth. What the rest of us, older people, have to say, look, this is why there's voting, and there's this force, and it's got a certain momentum, and if people just say the system's working fine, that's ultimately not going to work. We've got to have effective ways to harness this legitimate frustration.
And what do you think when you get to this end? I mean, I don't know what the, you know, I was trying to propose some sorts of solution. I honestly think my idea about the taxation, because it's multifaceted, and we've talked about this, the board structure doesn't work. I mean, are you going to give somebody $300 billion before you pay a dividend? Really? I mean, who picked that board? Not the shareholders necessarily, right? I mean, the whole thing seems to most people is being co-opted. So when you hear somebody like me saying, well, you know, I think if we were to do something like raise the tax rate for corporations to the same as an individual, since the Supreme Court says they are an individual in terms of being able to buy in politicians and stuff, and decide that we're getting rid of the double taxation, if you pay out a dividend, that's deductible, because then that person has to pay it on the other end. And basically the answer I got was, you could do all these kind of tweaks you want. We think the thing is so screwed up, the only way it's going to make it fair is for the government to grab 85% of Elon Musk's money, because guess what? He didn't get it legitimately. And nobody, maybe you might have a Jonas Salk, you might have a Roosevelt, you might have a George Marshall, that you can pay that much. But all these other people that run the drug companies and everything, they never invented a drug in their life. They didn't do anything but land on top of a board, pick the board member, and get themselves a vote at a raise. I mean, that's people's attitude toward this. And then, boy, it's deep-seated.
It's deep-seated, and it's got to be, in my view, dealt with some informed logic that people are not necessarily willing to hear. But, you know, China and Russia are not such great places, and the government runs things there. In most countries in the world, the government runs things, and it's not so great for the ordinary people. So people have to learn that, but they got to be met partway where they're at. And I think the solutions, I think we kind of know the solutions. You were talking about George Stigler. He had a very beneficial, at times, influence on my life, because one of his aphorisms was, if you've never missed an airplane, you're wasting too much time at air terminals.
He would say something like that.
And that worked for me for a long time, until they got a lot more tougher on you got to report in an hour or two early, and I started missing multiple flights.
Yep. What he said one day was hilarious, Andrew. He goes, you know, when you start talking about economists, you know, opining on other subjects, he goes, all you got to do, walk up and down the street in front of here, look at the cars economists buy. He goes, they're all a bunch of crap. He goes, these guys have their opinions on the best car, they're all awful. He goes, plus look at all these guys, they all got sports coats with patches on their elbows. Who the hell wears patches on their elbows except economists?
that's great wisdom. He was a great man. But to get back to the solutions, I think you need multiple solutions in a coordinated, thoughtful way that is not that hard to impose. So you can't just do it by tweaking economic risks and rewards. You got to have enforcement. So yesterday, for example, China sentenced to life in prison the head of the multi-billion-dollar Evergrande
real estate place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember one of the first courses I ever took as an undergraduate in college, and they quoted the first criminologist in the world, Buffon, from I think that wasn't him. I'm getting older now, but at any rate, it was 200 years ago in France, and they said you need enforcement, but not draconian enforcement. You got to increase the likelihood of enforcement. So to apply that to the Chinese situation and some of ours, you don't stop fraudulent speculation in China or anywhere else, I think, by imposing absolutely draconian penalties on one person. You increase the risk of liability for more people, so that they, you know, maybe the enforcement goes up from 3% to 8%, and that sends the message, not, you know, off with their head for one person while everybody else gets away with it.
Well, it's okay to off with the head if it's never going to be you. We had a weirdo class at Chicago. It had to do with how the stuff you learned in all the other classes kind of put together. I forgot the guy's name, but one of the things was exactly what you're talking about, Andrew. You could have taught this class. It had to do with crime and punishment. And he said, well, let's take the murders and the rapes and stuff, the crimes of passion off the stage. Let's just talk about money crimes. And he says, we're going to assume for a second, again, you have to have your assumptions, that criminals are rational to a large extent. And he said, so if they're rational and it's a money crime, it's a very simple formula. The penalty has to be whatever they took divided by the chance of getting caught, which is basically what you just said. He said, so if somebody steals a case of beer and there's a 20% chance of them getting caught, the penalty has to be 5 cases of beer. That way, somebody's going to look at it and go, I'm probably not going to get anywhere unless I'm so smooth at it, I'm the one guy who's never going to get caught, which someone will probably feel that way. He says, so you can't, if you get enough policemen to where half the beer guys are going to get caught, maybe the fine of 2 cases is good enough because you're going to get caught and there's a lot of hassle with that. He said, but what we have now is useless, especially at the corporate level. I mean, if you get caught, like some of the banks were doing with the mortgage stuff back in the day, if you got a, you know, 1% chance of getting caught, then your fine is a third of what you made on the criminal enterprise. You're encouraging people. You're not discouraging them.
Well, exactly. And maybe it was about 6 years ago or something like that. I was covering the trial and then the guilty plea in a second jurisdiction of Paul Manafort, the former...
Andrew, I sense a little bit of a story here. Can you do it till after break?
Yeah, we're coming up on break.
SP futures down 42 now, and NASDAQ futures down 235. Jim, we have to talk about this, eh? Oh, we got gold is down $48 after being up some huge amount yesterday. So we're kind of getting a reversal after the buying of the 30 years. We'll be right back, Stocks and Jocks.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
We're back.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tomato, Jim Lawler on the board. Headline right now, and this is scary. We're going to talk about this with our guys in a second. Treasury yields flipped back the other way and are almost not quite where they were. with Bessent's. Here's the headline. Treasury yields rebound, wiping out the decline following Bessent's intervention. Well, first of all, it hasn't totally wiped it out, but it has wiped out some of it. That's a problem. If the market all of a sudden doesn't believe this shit all of a sudden, which is very possible. S&P futures down 43, NASDAQ futures down 252. We were unchanged when we came in, so this is all happening kind of recently. Dow's down 300 points. Over in Asia, again, the Nikkei had a huge down day yesterday. See if they bounced there. Nikkei did bounce a little bit. They're up 890, 1.3%. They were down 3% yesterday. Ouch. Hang Seng up 203.8%. Shanghai up 9. Call that flat. Well, they're up over there in Asia. Well, they were. Now, they closed before we started going down, so I don't know what that all means. DAX down 163.6%. FTSE up 53.5%. Check around down 40.5%, so down, but not heavy down over there. Bonds, and here's the issue, back up 6 basis points in a 10-year to 4.7. I don't think that's quite to the high. I think the high was 4.75, but still bad enough. Japan, 2.85, that's where our problem is, I think, right there. Oil up $3, $89, so whatever's going on in the Middle East is not good. Oil prices rise 3% as Trump sharpens Iran rhetoric amid talks impasse. There you go. Gold down $25, $45.19. It had a huge run up yesterday. Silver was up today, up 40 cents, $66.23. Foreign exchange, the yen, 158.9, is on the yen here. So they're getting close to that 60 number, which they don't like. Crypto, which had a huge rally yesterday, is up again today. $3,400, $71,820. So just as you would expect it, as you downgrade the dollar yesterday, up went gold, silver, and crypto. Jimmy, a lot of stuff there. What do you got for us, Traffic Weather Sports?
Okay, it is the 20th of August at 7:34 here in Chicago. Right now, the inbound Kennedy from the Jane Byrne is at 28 minutes. The inbound Edens is at 44, so we are rising there. Inbound Eisenhower at 38, and the inbound Dan Ryan is at 32. And the weather today, it is going to be a high of around 78. It is currently 63 with partly cloudy in Phoenix. Again, extreme hot warning, extreme heat, excuse me. High of, it's currently 82 with a high of 109. There might be some thunder. In regards to sports, Cubs lose, which means the Sox won. Back to you, Chief.
Guys, are you, I know we have to have Andrew finish his story, but are you a little surprised that this intervention by Bessent basically lasted a day? I'm real surprised that these rates are coming back up this quick, aren't you guys?
Yeah.
I thought it would last longer than this.
I can only concur.
Well, finish what you were saying. We were talking about that.
Well, first, we were talking about strict enforcement.
Yeah.
I have to admire your strict enforcement of the half-hour break deadline. You can see I was about to be a violator.
So, well, it's because our friend Mr. Lawler... He's nudging in my ear saying, hey, we're coming up to it. So blame Jim or congratulate Jim, one way or the other.
That's all very good. So to tighten up the story, in the trial it came out that the government had prepared and actually won a verdict that he had basically not paid taxes on something like $55 million in income derived from advising in part Russian-allied Eastern European clients. And he did go to jail briefly, then he was pardoned. But I keep thinking, well, what about the $55 million in income and with largely unpaid taxes and all the rest of it? That was... not a deterrence, let's put it
that way. Well, as Leona Helmsley once said, taxes are only for the little people.
Yeah, well, I'm sure a lot of people feel that way. I have this constant, you guys, I think, listening enough, this constant back and forth with Carl about, you know, how bad some of this stuff is. And you know, we've been doing this for 8-10 years, you know, and you guys have been on, you know, some length of that time. And I'm getting this weird feeling. I hope maybe it's, hopefully it's not because I'm aging, but I always thought that if we use some sobering fixes, if we all agreed we have a problem, like our deficit, how do you not think 40 trillion is a problem? That I always thought you could get, you know, the right people in the room and have some sort of proposals that would, you know, work against what we're doing now and turn the bus around to the point where we could pull it off. And Carl's always been of the opinion that we're beyond that. You know, you need to, you know, figuratively hang people like in the street tomorrow because we're way beyond any sort of rational fix. And I really, for a long period of time, thought I was right. Boy, oh boy, I'm not so sure. I mean, you look at, I mean, this degradation in corporate governance, where Musk hires the guys to give him the raise, is not the way this was set up when corporations were set up. I don't know at the extreme it's gotten. I have no idea how the hell to fix it. I mean, you know, we talked the other day, and we had Kenny Pulcheri was on, and out of the blue, I don't know if you listen to Kenny, but he was talking about his wife. Fortunately, she's fine. Wasn't feeling so hot. raced her to the emergency room, and you know, did the couple of heart tests, you know, the EKG and the enzyme test, and she was fine. She was there an hour, and the bill was like $11,000 or something. I don't know how the hell the collective we, can't pay that. I don't care if it's government doing it, Bernie Sanders, you goofball, or whether it's insurance or whether it's you and me personally. The number is too high. I don't see how the hell you break up the Northwesterns of the world and tell the top 50 people on top of the place you're making five times too much. And by the way, you got 10 times too much space for what you're doing. I don't know how the hell you do that in time to do anything when we're talking about $50 billion in deficit in the last 3 days. I mean, am I just losing the focus, or am I losing the fight, or what am I doing?
Let me hop in on that.
Please.
I think you're right. It looks grim. It looks horrible. But let me offer a bit of hope, and drawn from the world of sports, and this helps me justify watching some fight YouTube videos, because maybe it's useful.
For those that don't know, Andrew is a boxer.
Well, but more importantly, I'm a watcher of, and I was looking in recent days at a couple of Ali fights, and I was studying this knockout of Liston, and he actually hit him. It wasn't a big blockbuster punch, but he hit him on the point of the jaw, and it was the same way he defeated Ernie Terrell, which was right on the point of the jaw that snapped the head around, and they both went down like a sack of potatoes. And to apply this to your question, which is very legitimate, I think, if you have people who know what they're doing and have maybe not just one punch, but have an array of corrective proven methods to fix the problems, I think a tremendous amount of progress could be made to correct the ship, to turn the bus around, or even another crazy analogy, turn the Pullman car around.
Yeah.
It's harder on the tracks. But I think it can be done if people just think about what needs to be done and who can do it and how.
Well, I think, you know, my heart is with you, but I also know we're talking about August, and I think some stuff is a lot worse than it was in January. I don't know if it's going to be that much better by December. So this year, I don't see any corporate governance reform. I don't see any nonprofit reform. I don't see any insurance reform. Now, does that mean we're going to start next year and make some progress? I don't even think we're staying even on this stuff, Andrew. I mean, I would love, by the way, I would love for you to be right. Do you think you really are?
We can only hope and work toward a hopeful result.
Well, as you,
what's the alternative?
I know, I understand, but you guys are way more into this because, you know, I got to turn around and manage money all day, and I keep my eye on the news for financial news. If you listen to CNBC all day, Bloomberg all day, Fox all day, maybe Bloomberg, do you have anybody even talking about the stuff we're talking about?
No, I'm a little surprised because, you know, people are relying on these sources for news, and they must be satisfying some need, or they wouldn't be so financially successful as news conduits. But I'm not seeing it.
Wayne. I'm going to lead in. Can I lead into Wayne here? What I'd like to do is, Eric was talking about when he worked for the Tribune, for the whatever the UPI desk and those kinds of things, where people went out. What? I'm not going to say that, you know, the news was perfect because it wasn't, but it was competitive. There were four newspapers in Chicago that couldn't wait to say the other paper had botched the story, right? But how do you separate? Like yesterday when Bessent came out with this thing, CNBC, you name it, all the lead-ins, even on the radio, was they're doing this to lower mortgage costs and lower interest costs for people, and they're going to get the economy stopped. Not one of them said, oh, by the way, the flip side of this is more money in the system, and probably 4 months from now, your inflation is going to be higher instead of lower, and they're nobody gives the flip side to what they did yesterday. Now, my question to Wayne is, because I think he's probably out of the three of us, how much of what the news you see on CNBC and Fox, Fox Business, how much of it is so, I'll use the term, jaundiced, by they want Bessent on there for an interview? And if they tear apart what the guy just did yesterday, or even ask a question about it, is he going to say, I'm not going on there, or is Trump going to go out and bash CNBC, or... I mean, how much of this is really news, or is it ratings? And
it's PR also, as you're getting to, look, with the there's been massive staff cuts at all these networks. Now, you mentioned Fox and CNBC. Fox definitely.
It's Fox Business I'm talking about, not Fox.
Fox Business. Yeah. They're always trying to seek favor with this administration. But what's happened with the staff cuts is you used to have people who would book guests, and then you had the producers who would, you know, give some hints to the bookers. Here's some people we want to line up. Now you've got them. They're both the same individual now. The producer is also the booker. And then you've got the same people involved in some of the editorial content, and that makes for not a news network, but a PR operation. I remember years ago here in the National Press Club, I always wondered why aren't there a lot of people from the Washington Post here, and the answer was, because Ben Bradley, the managing editor, says, I'm not going to pay the dues for the press club because they're all a bunch of PR flacks. And that was back then. It's much, much worse now. And the way the news is being... it's not even news. You back in the 60s, 70s, and into the 80s, I would say about the time Cronkite retired from CBS, which apparently was a forced retirement. He didn't want to go.
Well, I didn't know that. What was that all about?
Yeah. CBS said they had a mandatory retirement age, and then you look around, hey, What about Andy Rooney?
Yeah.
he was around forever. You know, apparently they just decided, you know, I think it was the Tisch family in New York owned CBS at the time. And Cronkite, you know, he was up there, but he was probably at his best when he retired. I think it was right after the 1980 election. Or it might have been 84. You turn on these cable news channels now, and the business ones as well. All you see is a bunch of people sitting around a table chit chatting, like they're Andy and I at the corner bar at the press club on a Friday night, just, you know, talking, and then people come over, they get guests on. They have maybe a little argument, but nothing out of hand. And that's what passes for news today. It's, you know, it's ridiculous. In the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, the evening news broadcast was 22 minutes because you had to throw in the commercial time. You got more news in 22 minutes than you get in 24 hours today.
Well, that's the whole point. You have to extend. I mean, as much as I like doing my show, God bless, if I was doing it for 10 hours, I'd be tired of hearing myself talk.
Yeah, I mean, it's... And we've also lost the news radio stations, for the most part. WCBS in New York used to be 24-hour news. Traffic and weather on the nines.
Well, BBM is still here, but you know what? They were part of CBS. They all got sold. So when you, I don't know if ABC bought them or they contracted with ABC. But if you heard the news now, it's all from ABC, not CBS.
Yeah. ABC is at least not buckling under. They're suing the Trump administration.
But Andrew, well, you're
buckling under earlier. CBS, I think, just closed down their nationwide radio network. And one of Wayne's hobbies, he often shares the fruits of it, is finding on YouTube, I guess, old news broadcasts from 30 or 40 years ago that he sometimes shares with me. And he says, look at what they were covering. They were really covering these...
Yeah, military coups in the nation of Guinea in West Africa made it onto the national news back then.
Well, the local news, I don't know what it's like in Washington or Florida. But here, I mean, I'm not saying they're wrong. They've made the determination that people are getting their national news off the internet, off something or whatever. But if you like go on Channel 9 News at night, which is now 2 hours, it's almost all local. You know, heavy emphasis on the weather, all kinds of stuff on the sports. They're not. If it's a big deal, I mean, like if war started, they'll do 2 minutes of that. That they probably get from somebody else, but they're not. You know, it's not like they have where the Daily News in World War II had people on the front lines. I mean, you're not. That's not happening. I mean, even the Tribune. Look at the front page of the Tribune. One of our contributors on Monday, John Lee, calls me up yesterday. Go, I just paid a bunch for this newspaper. Look at the two items on the front page are like some local gossip. Had nothing to do with
like the National Enquirer.
Yeah, but is that decisions they've made that people aren't looking to the 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock news for national stuff? Is it that way in Washington? I mean, the business part of it is horrible. There isn't one.
There's both a short term strategy that's been in place, lead with murders and weather, and to some extent. They have their consultants and prove that people are going to look at, you know, car accidents and murders. But it certainly doesn't inform the public in a useful way. But also, I think combined with this is an aspect of the ownership, which is don't give people really solid, important information that helps them understand politics and government, because who knows what an informed public might do.
Why are we so? Follow that up, Andrew. Why do we seem so happy with a dumbed down population?
Well, we're not happy. The three of us most of your listeners aren't. Or they wouldn't be tuned in. But I actually, when I went to University of Chicago Law School, spent a year on an independent project about regulation of the media and what's called market failures in kind of antitrust and other regulation.
So you had to come across Stigler's work a lot when you were there.
Yeah, yeah. And it was under a kind of famous professor there, Cass Sunstein. And here was my conclusion, that people think that when they get the media, there's an adage that comes from Justice Louis Brandeis. What's the adage? That basically you get what you pay for, and that the market is working with media because you subscribe, you pay your money, or the advertiser pays. But the conclusion I came up with, which is relatively novel, I think, but important and relevant here, is that for the most part, people are not paying for the media now. People are not paying you a subscription to hear us. The ads are, when you get to the major organizations like TV, that pays a lot of the freight. But when we see the regulation, the antitrust regulation, what the FCC is doing on these billion-dollar deals, that's far more important than subscription revenue or advertising revenue to the owners. So I think last week we were talking about purchase price of what the Lakers, how did it go from $10 billion to $12 billion?
Well, we got to talk about that next week because Jeannie Buss doesn't want to sell.
Yeah. But to take the big picture, the last quick point, when you're talking about billion-dollar media deals, it becomes vital to be on the good side of the regulators.
Yep.
When you're the owners. And that message maybe doesn't filter down to the street-level reporter or even that person's editor.
Well, he just gets fired. He certainly gets the message.
Well, they kind of see signs, but they're not getting the memos. But the top lawyers and top news managers, I'll call them, and the corporate suite, they definitely understand you do not want to antagonize the FCC or the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Well, what is two real quick questions. I'll lob one at Wayne, actually probably both of them at Wayne. What is it, take somebody who's really good, like a John Cass or a Cheryl Atkinson or somebody, and they, no paper wants them, right, because they're too controversial, and they go off on their own. How much does their performance, and again, they're both really damn good, degrade because they're not in the newsroom? It has to be dramatic. I mean,
let me jump in quickly. I know Cheryl Atkinson. She left CBS and she became a whistleblower, and she got very involved in the Whistleblower Summit that I'm one of the part of the host committee here in Washington. And she, as you say, she's very capable. She was very upset at some things that CBS was doing, and that was her book and her reason for departure. And she's now in the Sinclair Network, which owns more stations than any other network.
By the way, she was on the show a couple times. I would love to have her back, but I have no way to get in touch with her.
Well, she's, maybe I can get you an address. She's very capable, but she's made her peace with her new employer, which is in many ways tilting the, well, they're an opinion network, extremely right-wing, and they've offered her a spot, and she's able to exercise her capabilities, but it's as part of a behind-the-scenes effort to shape public opinion in America to the right. So there's that.
I got to ask.
Add, when you leave the corporate position, you lose access to like travel money, travel budget, and you're really it's either fund it yourself, but if you have no means of income, you can't do that. Now, a lot of people, including myself, we've all wound up over on Substack. So I'm there with Jim Acosta and Don Lemon and all the other former corporate anchors. But my God, I'm thinking if Trump decides to go after Substack, he will essentially cut off all independent journalism in the United States.
We only have a few minutes, guys. I got to ask you this question. Obviously, we'll be asking it every week. Election coming up, and you know, we've been talking for an hour now about how does anything get solved, and every day you don't solve something, it seems to get worse. I think we all agree on that. Election 51-49 Democrat in the Senate and a two-person advantage in the House. Next 2 years, how does anything get done? Or they get get 51 in the Senate and they lose the House by two people. What?
I think they're going to have a good cushion in both the Senate and the House.
Even so.
I'd say four seats at least in the Senate and, 20 to 30 in the House.
Okay, so if they get that, now what?
Well, it depends on whether the people come in really know what they're doing and what they want to do, or whether they're just getting acquainted with things and being told what to do and be clueless.
But well, that's what I mean. Is the fractions within the two parties almost as bad as the fractions party to party?
I really think that based on some of the election returns, if the Dems take the House, Hakeem Jeffries will not be the Speaker. Somebody's going to make a motion to vacate the chair like what happened to McCarthy. And I think we'll have a different speaker.
Any idea who?
I don't think it'll be somebody from Brooklyn, New York. And that would include AOC. Well, she's from the Bronx. But I think it'll be somebody from a different part of the country. Same thing with the Senate Majority Leader. I do not think it'll be Chuck Schumer.
Oh, I would go with you on that, but then again, who?
I can't. We'll have to see who steps forward, but I think there will be people who will step forward after the general.
And then when I hope they're not every single day just fighting with Trump. That's we don't need that for 2 years.
Oh, I think there's going to be investigations, but I don't think there's going to be a move to impeachment.
I hope not.
At the outset, yeah. But I think there's going to be a lot of investigations, and I think there's going to be a lot of nobody's going to go to jail, because if somebody is contemptuous of Congress or perjures themselves, it's referred to the Justice Department, led by Trump's personal lawyer, Todd Blanche. So,
yeah,
end of story.
Well, you guys have to promise me now, when you start dropping $10,000 bets on who's going to win these elections, you got to let us know who you're following.
I'll have to check my Kalshi account.
There you go. As usual, good stuff, guys. Hey, guess who's coming back tomorrow? Larissa will be on tomorrow with Kevin. That'll be fun.
Right.
So you guys are the best. Got to see you one of these days. S&P Futures up down 30. NASDAQ Futures down 156. We were down more. Now we're coming back. This morning is very confusing, like all days these days, it seems. But back tomorrow, Stocks and Chops. Good job, Jimmy.
That's all, folks.